From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, an update from the Michigan Public Newsroom on the spread of cyclosporiasis in Michigan.
CDC has only linked 15 of those to this iceberg lettuce, so there's still an open question as to where this is coming from.
Then, a mystery around moose in northern Minnesota and what it tells us about the health of wildlife in Great Lakes states.
You know, using the dogs like this and sending them into areas for confirmation of birth, confirmation that either the calf is alive or it died. We get really good data and we can save time.
Also, State Senator Mallory McMorrow gives us her take on this week's primary results.
But to me, people were looking for the wrong takeaway. It's not going left or going more center or going middle. It's recognizing in this moment, the Democratic Party is a big tent party.
All that coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, what Mallory McMorrow took away from what she saw in Tuesday's primaries.
But to me, people were looking for the wrong takeaway. It's not going left or going more center or going middle. It's recognizing in this moment, the Democratic Party is a big tent party.
That's ahead, but first, ever since cyclosporiasis began to surge in Michigan this year, two people have died. Nearly 200 others have been hospitalized, and our case count is now into the five figures. Public health officials have been scrambling to trace record-setting cyclosporiasis outbreaks that have now been tracked to at least 47 states. Michigan Public's senior environment reporter Kate Furby is with us to talk more. Kate, hi.
Hi.
Also with us today, Kate Wells, who covers public health for KFF Health News. Kate Wells, hello.
Hello.
So, Kate Wells, let's start with you. And I mean, these deaths, what do we know about who these people were?
So, very little. The state health department is not saying much at all. They're just saying that based on medical records, these people had significant underlying health conditions that may have been impacted by cyclosporiasis and dehydration. They're also saying that both of these people became ill prior to that lettuce recall in July. They are also trying to reassure people by saying, look, cyclosporiasis is not generally life-threatening. Deaths in the U.S. are rare. But you also do not want to downplay this here, right? I mean, a lot of people have underlying health conditions. And a lot of people are vulnerable to serious illnesses. You've got young kids, older adults, pregnant women, anybody with a compromised immune system. We are talking about a lot of people here.
I just keep wondering how this got so huge. It seems like everyone has either had it or knows someone who's had it. And the results are just not pretty.
Yeah, one of the local public health nurses that I talked to in Washtenaw County, she has interviewed now more than 100 of these cases. And she told me that the vast majority are telling her this is the most painful illness that they have ever experienced. Although, in fairness, one person when I was with her did tell her that they would like to have it again and that they have really enjoyed the weight loss.
So you've got a real range
of perspectives, but it is unlike anything that we have seen in terms of cyclosporiasis before.
I understand you've got some tape for us from the Secretary of Health and Human Services.
Yeah, I think it's been interesting to watch this contrast between you're seeing local and state health officials take this very seriously and talk about this in terms of like, here are these numbers that we're having and these investigations that we're doing. But meanwhile, you are seeing federal health officials in charge of the CDC and HHS almost kind of downplay it. RFK Jr., the U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary, said in mid-July that this was under control. And then here's what he told USA Today earlier this week.
We have a surveillance system in place, and it's working better than it's ever worked in history. In 2018, it took them, I think, 6 to 9 weeks to identify the outbreak. We identified the big outbreak in 2 weeks. We've had six more since then, and that's typical in the summers. We get a lot of cyclospora outbreak every summer.
But while that is true, yes, we see cyclospora every year, nothing about this current outbreak is typical. I mean, we are talking about thousands and thousands more cases than we usually have. And maybe previously in the last like 10 years, you'll see an outbreak pop up in like 3 states. But as you mentioned, we have 47 states right now reporting cases linked to this iceberg lettuce. CDC has only linked 15 of those to this iceberg lettuce. So there's still an open question as to where this is coming from.
Kate Furby, I've been meaning to ask you, it can feel totally overwhelming about what to do. I mean, what are we just off veggies for the summer? How do we prevent this from happening again?
Yeah, it's super confusing. I literally had a friend reach out to me at the beginning of this, and she was like, we're worried about you specifically because I'm famous for loving a big salad and also having stomach issues.
Jeez.
But I've been talking to local vendors at farmers market because I was curious if more people were eating local as a result of this outbreak, right? It's happening at a national level with a wide distribution. And it seems like nationwide, there is a surge in market shoppers. And I talked to farmers who told me they're selling out of lettuce first thing in the morning. I talked to families who said they felt safer eating produce from the market. But it doesn't have to be farmers market lettuce. I think my takeaway from this is maybe we need to better understand where our food comes from in general, and maybe be a little more flexible with what we eat.
For sure. Well, I mean, it is August now, Kate. What do you think we should be expecting next in terms of the outbreak?
Yeah, so we know that Cyclospora, the parasite, it's a warm weather loving tropical, subtropical bug. So that's why it's a summer thing. So there is some concern that with climate change and warmer or longer summers, we could extend the season. But the hope is that it'll start winding down as temperatures cool off.
Is anything being done in terms of testing to try to prevent spread next summer?
Yeah, so really exciting. Scientists at Michigan State University are working on wastewater surveillance systems. So this is a holdover from COVID, where we were testing wastewater to see where it is.
And so, I remember this, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they're currently using it to test for viruses, bacteria, fungi, but now they are adapting it to test for Cyclospora. So the idea is in the future, it could be used for monitoring, but also hopefully prevention.
Wow. I mean, I think this is the first time outside of COVID I've ever heard that kind of testing being mobilized.
I'm fully obsessed with wastewater testing at this point.
Kate Wells, we had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with Michigan's chief medical officer, and she suggested, I could tell she was being measured in her words, but she suggested this outbreak has been harder to get hands around, partly because the federal government has cut back on the public health infrastructure that focuses on infectious disease. What have you observed that maybe was present for prior outbreaks 5-10 years ago that's maybe not happening right now?
Yeah, I think you want to distinguish two things here. I think you want to talk about how our food surveillance system and our public health system have been underfunded for a long time. The folks that I talk with who have been looking at outbreaks like this, who have been looking at foodborne illness, say this has gone back for many, many years. So you have this underfunded system to begin with. And then you add on top of it places like Washington County's health department. They have basically been in this whiplash the last 2 years. They had a CDC employee there who was furloughed and then fired and then rehired. They've had programs that have had to stop and then restart. And the public health nurse that I talked to there, she was previously down in the immunizations clinic and doing STI testing. And starting back in the spring when that county had a measles outbreak, she had to basically leave that clinic and handle it was all hands on deck. And she has not been back in that clinic since then, because then the cyclosporiasis cases started pouring in. So you have fewer and fewer people who are trying to do these jobs that keep getting bigger and bigger.
Gosh. Maybe we should just run through safe food handling as a really basic level. I think a lot of people have heard this before, but Kate Furby, if we are bringing vegetables home, what's the recommended plan for handling food right now?
Yeah, I mean, the safest thing you can do is cook your vegetables, right? Heat kills the Cyclospora. But if you want to eat lettuce, cooked lettuce is
weird. Just a weird
I was looking on Epicurious for the recipes, and they're not out there
now. There's a grilled Caesar I don't hate. So Cyclospora is pretty sticky. So if you're trying to wash it off, you want to really be scrubbing your vegetables. Although I'm not sure that experts really think that. It's pretty hard to get it off, so you're really going to be wanting to scrub it. I think the hope is that you're bringing something home that doesn't have it on it already.
So in the first place.
Avoiding bagged lettuce is key, because with a head of lettuce, you can peel the outer layers off.
Yeah, and I mean, we have had some reporting about, the source of this pollution, but I guess it's only this to say, it's not like if you go get food, you can just put on some hand sanitizer on your hands and you're golden.
Yeah, and in fact, I've read that the hand sanitizer doesn't kill the cyclospora the way it does, you know, other viruses.
Kate Wells, you're shaking your head.
I think what has been so frustrating about this for people is that, like, and I'm sorry, I'm gonna go off here on my like public health little box here. This is not supposed to be like an individual consumer problem. Like, there isn't anything that the individual person at Kroger can do or Meijer and be like, oh, this lettuce is okay and that lettuce isn't. That has been made so much harder by the fact that this system simply this is not under control. Whatever you're hearing from federal health officials, we are hearing local and state health officials. The words that they've used to describe this federal response to me has been vague, scary, slow. This is not something that individual people can navigate as much as we may want to. And even now, when you look at the Taylor Farms recall, it is still almost entirely just like these impenetrable codes that you can't, it's not like you can look at what's in your fridge or what's in the grocery store and then compare these. And so I think where we kind of get frustrated and lost here is this gap between, we're not supposed to have a food system where like individually you just figure it out on your own.
Yeah. You are now part of a network, Wells, KFF Health reporting, that is a national partnership. I mean, what have you heard from reporters in other states?
Well, it's been really helpful to talk to folks. My colleague Stephanie Armour and I did a piece on, not to like freak people out more, but if this is how we are handling cyclosporiasis right now, which is, if there's any silver lining, like this is not typically a illness where we do see people die. If this is how cyclosporiasis is being handled, there are food safety experts around the country right now who are genuinely concerned about how we will be able to handle much more dangerous outbreaks like Listeria and E. coli that have killed people. And that is their concern right now, that this should be a warning sign to us.
My guests have been Kate Wells of KFF Health News. Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And also, we've been speaking with Kate Furby, senior environment reporter in the Michigan Public Newsroom. Thank you, Kate.
Thanks, April.
We need to take a quick break now. When we come back, Points North, our friends at Interlochen Public Radio, have a mystery for us from the wilds of northern Minnesota.
So she's just kind of hanging out. And then all of a sudden, she starts making, you see how crazy she went there? Like just jumping all over the place.
The dogs are on it. That story when we come back. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Just a note that we're a week away from the launch of a brand new show here on Michigan Public. It is a live call-in, and the host is a good friend of ours, Stephen Henderson, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who used to host Detroit Today on our sister station, WDET. The show is called Michigan, We Need to Talk. Perfect addition for your election year listening. Don't miss it, starting at 8 p.m. a week from now, Thursday, August 13th, here on Michigan Public. Something is killing moose calves deep in the woods of northeast Minnesota, and the clues left behind are scarce. Flecks of blood, bits of flesh, bone splinters. So to get answers, scientists are turning to dogs. Our friends at the Points North podcast from Interlochen Public Radio have been looking into this. Dan Wanshura takes it from here.
Something seems wrong with moose cow number 214.
So she's just kind of hanging out. And then all of a sudden, she starts making, you see how crazy she went there? Like just jumping all over the place.
Anna Weeses points at a tangle of zigzagging lines on a satellite map. It's all of Moose Cow 214's movements over the last couple weeks, tracked with a GPS collar.
And then you've got this out and back, just like that.
Anna can tell a lot by these lines. She tracks almost 50 moose like this in Minnesota's dense north woods. 2 weeks ago, 214's line didn't move much. She found a spot near a wetland and gave birth to a calf there. And then, not long after, 214 ran away before doubling back. That's a typical sign of distress.
It's almost like she's confused, like this calf isn't following her.
Like this calf could have been killed. In some years, around 80% of moose calves born here don't survive. Most are eaten by bears or wolves. Is that what happened here? Did 214 run away, scared by a predator, then come back to check whether her baby was still alive? The GPS lines can't answer all that.
So we're just going to go look and see if we can find evidence of a calf and then see if, you know, there's any moose parts.
Moose parts. Flecks of blood, bits of flesh, bone splinters. But to find any of that, Anna needs some help.
Hi, buddy.
Hello.
So this is Wheeler.
This is Wheeler.
This is Points North, a podcast about the land, water, and inhabitants of the Great Lakes. I'm Dan Wanshura. Today, a detection dog is going to figure out if this calf is dead or alive and show us a world we can't access using his nose. Producer Ellie Katz takes it from here.
Wheeler is a mutt with a lot of chocolate lab in him. He arrives on the scene with his usual tools, his harness and his handler, whose name is Stu Hoig.
And then he wears a bell. That's what you'll hear dinging. So I know where he's at. It helps. And then when he indicates, he stops moving.
So when the bell stops, it means Wheeler's found something.
All right, so you ready to work? All right, let's go find it. Let's go find it.
Hey, let's go find it.
It's 5:30 a.m. A cool, humid morning like this is good for holding smells on the landscape. Mosquitoes hover in small clouds. We bushwhack back to the swampy, muggy wetland where moose cow 214 made her weird movement. We go under branches and over wet, rotten logs.
Whoa, that was a beautiful hole.
My leg falls knee-deep into a big, mossy hole.
That's crazy. This is a thick thicket.
Wheeler is a young dog, and he's a little overexcited this morning. He's wiggly, and he keeps thinking my microphone is a big, furry ball.
Don't eat my microphone.
He caught sight of that. He was like, ooh.
Wheeler's a detection dog. He's trained to track specific smells. Today's assignment is moose. Stu got Wheeler from a shelter out west. Like a lot of detection dogs, Wheeler would not have fit well with a family. He's got a lot of energy. He'd be pretty rough around kids.
For this kind of thing, it's great. It's great for him.
Wheeler bounds ahead through little green clusters of bunchberry and thick patches of hazelnut.
I'm just pushing my body through branches. You can hear all the mic handling noise. There are just so many snags.
Wheeler, this way, this way.
He is much better at this than we are.
You know, he just kind of moves through the woods really well. He's just kind of gliding through. And
Anna's a biologist for the Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior Chippewa.
When he catches a scent or an odor, his head kind of pops up a little bit. He gets a little bit perkier, like his tail is a little bit higher.
The tribe has hired detection dogs to help them with their moose research for 7 years now. It's because a dog's sense of smell is far more powerful than ours.
Well, I like to think about dogs smelling in color.
Dr. Cindy Otto leads a center for working dogs at the University of Pennsylvania's vet school.
They see the world through the odor patterns much more than they see visually. And really what they're doing is painting a picture of smells. And the incredible thing about smells is, unlike a visual, we see what's there. With a smell, they see what's been there.
In Wheeler's nose, there's a honeycomb-shaped tissue, jam-packed with scent receptors. A couple hundred million scent receptors. That's about 40 times as many as we have in our little noses. Wheeler can tap into a whole cornucopia of smell that's totally invisible to us.
Coca-Cola is a classic example. You smell something, you're like, ah, that's Coke. Whereas the dog is smelling the vanilla and the lemon and, you know, all of these other components that are in it. You know, if someone put a drop of something else in the Coke, we're not going to smell it because all we smell is Coke. But they would smell, you know, whatever it is that they were trained to smell, if it even in that background.
Dogs can tell two twins apart. They can smell cancer in blood samples. And they can distinguish a moose calf from an adult moose and how long ago it was around. Humans lost the ability to pick up on these subtle chemical clues during evolution. But many mammals, bears, wolves, moose, still rely primarily on smell to make sense of the world around them.
All right, buddy, find it.
And Wheeler is a window to that world.
It's so hard to see just a tuft of fur or, you know, a piece of hide. It'd be next to impossible to find some of these calves.
Wheeler's nose can do it quickly. Not because he loves the smell of moose, but because he's obsessed with his tennis ball. Stu, his trainer, relies on that obsession. He uses moose scat and hair and body parts to teach Wheeler what smells to find. And when Wheeler gets it right, he gets his reward. A few minutes of tug-of-war with the ball.
I want something, right? I want to find evidence of the calf, and then he wants his tennis ball. And it's like, I have the tennis ball, he knows how to find that evidence, and then we kind of work out a deal.
Yeah, we're using the dog to translate what's going on in the landscape.
This way, bud, this way.
Wheeler's little bell slows down. He lowers his head to sniff something, snorting a little bit. Stu calls it being in odor.
It's kind of like that intense sniffing. He's in odor. There's something there that is interesting.
But Wheeler doesn't stop. He lifts his head and keeps moving. Whatever he smelled isn't moose. He knows he won't get his ball for it. For Wheeler, finding remains of a dead calf is just a fun game. But for scientists, it's one more piece in a big puzzle. There were once about 8,000 moose living in northern Minnesota. Then about 20 years ago, the moose population started to crash, and it was cut in half. It was almost unimaginable that these massive animals, these icons of the North Woods that bounded through snow and swam across lakes without issue, could just disappear. A parasitic brainworm was killing moose.
So the brainworm doesn't stop burrowing and ends up burrowing into the brain,
causing neurological issues and death. It was one big reason moose were being driven to the brink. So scientists in the Grand Portage Band started gathering as much data as they could about moose life cycles and using dogs to do it more quickly than in the past.
You know, using the dogs like this and sending them into areas for confirmation of birth, confirmation that either the calf is alive or it died. We get really good data and we can save time.
We finally reached the wetland, the specific coordinates where Moose Cow 214 made that sudden, erratic movement. The swamp is surrounded by cedar and aspen and willow.
I bet there's something around here. That might be one.
Wheeler starts to systematically scan the area for signs of a dead calf. He hits on something. Not tufts of hair or bone splinters or blood, but adult moose scat, oval-shaped and brown, like mini footballs. The scat is a couple weeks old. There's a crust on each pellet.
Like a faint cow smell?
It's solid evidence that a moose was here recently. Almost certainly cow 214. But what about 214's baby? That's after the break. On this side of the wetland, there's just scat and some trees gnawed by beavers. So we follow Wheeler around to the other side. As we move, there are more signs of adult moose.
Oh, you can see that the moose broke off that sapling there.
But still, no sign of a calf, dead or alive. Wheeler keeps searching, trotting through the brush like a deer, his nose low to the ground. Here's Dr. Otto again.
There's a game that people play that's called Where's Waldo? And you have to find the little guy with the glasses and the red and white striped hat among all of these others. And as humans, we can do that. And I equate that to dogs finding their odor in a very, very complex background.
Wheeler is looking for his own little Waldo, some piece of moose calf hidden in all the brush. Wheeler knows what to look for, because he's found it before. A few days ago, he and Stu checked on another site. They did the same thing we're doing today, hiked to a spot where a different moose cow was making strange, erratic movements on the GPS.
It was like this, a clear day, like 60s. And maybe 3/4 mile back in, he cut away, straight away from me, and started hooking left. And he hits on something, and I come up, and it's just the hoof of a calf, and that's a sign that it could be a wolf kill with.
With just bits and pieces of the calf left behind. But then Wheeler found something even bigger, a few feet away. An entire moose calf carcass, or really the skin of a moose calf carcass.
The skull was out, the innards were out. No bones left in it except for those lower legs.
Stu realized this was a bear kill, not a wolf kill.
It was wild.
Bears will eat them in a very specific manner that, you know, they skin them, and it's almost like a puppet, like a morbid puppet.
This discovery is the whole reason they're out here. Scientists can't get rid of brainworm, but they can figure out which animals kill these calves, and they can use that to try and help more calves survive. Like, they've been setting up bear baiting stations. Basically, big tubs of bear trail mix to draw the predators away from moose calves in the spring. Something they're testing right now. Anna sometimes names the moose she sees on her wildlife cameras or encounters during GPS collaring missions. One calf she called Jet because of how he ran and jumped around his mom. Another moose was Puddles. But for both her and Stu, it's not particularly emotional to find these kills. It's just the cycle of an ecosystem.
You feel a bit of accomplishment and proud of the dog, happy for the dog. Yeah, it's probably more than anything.
On today's search at the wetland, we've found a couple signs of adult moose. Scat, a broken sapling, but so far, nothing else. We've been at it, looking around this swamp, for almost an hour. Wheeler will need a rest soon. But before we head back, he leads us to the muddy edge of the wetland. And there in the muck are two pairs of moose tracks.
If you can see that, these two are little, and then the big calf tracks.
Yeah, here. We got mom and calf tracks here in the mud.
It seems like maybe they were, you know, working in here, and surely the calf was around somewhere.
So it does tell me that she at least brought a calf here. And it doesn't necessarily tell me that, you know, it's still alive, although I kind of suspect just from our searches right now, it probably is.
It's a good boy. Good job, buddy.
Wheeler gets to go play in the marshy water for a few minutes to cool off. The more we look around, the more convinced Anna is that this calf is still alive. And the erratic movement its mom made was just a natural movement to and from the wetland with her calf as it grew old enough to travel. This spring, things have actually gone better for moose. 36 moose cows gave birth, and the team has only found 7 dead calves. That's a far cry from the 80% mortality in past years.
Makes Stu's job a little bit more boring, but That's a good thing.
Maybe the bear baiting stations helped this spring. Or maybe wolf and bear populations are just down. But there is a consensus on one thing. Minnesota's moose population, although half its original size, is stabilizing for now. Staying stable is not a given. So the work keeps going.
It's kind of a puzzle. You know, we're doing this without getting eyes on the animals. We're collecting signs from the woods and from GPS movements, and then using a dog's nose to tell you what's going on in the woods. Did you find what you expected to find?
We hike back. Wheeler gets a drink of water and pants, his long tongue hanging out. Then he climbs into his kennel in the back of Stu's truck.
Hey, sit down.
Two chocolate eyes stare out at us. Below them, a long brown nose sticks out between the metal bars, still sniffing.
That episode was produced by Ellie Katz. It was edited by Morgan Springer and me, Dan Wanshura. Music by Blue Dot Sessions.
Time for a break. When we return, State Senator Mallory McMorrow reflects on the primary. That's next. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. It was a photo finish in the Democratic primary this week, determining the party's nominee for a U.S. Senate seat. Abdul El-Sayed, former health director for Detroit, ran as a champion of Medicare for All. He won endorsements from Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and the UAW, and he promised voters that if they would help him defeat a well-funded opponent, Congresswoman Haley Stevens, he would send the Republican Party's nominee, Mike Rogers, packing in November.
You're not supposed to be able to beat $70 million of outside spending, a record amount of money spent in a campaign against a Democrat in a primary in any campaign. You're not supposed to be able to beat that. And what we showed is that the power of our many is greater than the power of their money.
El-Sayed's win was decided Wednesday morning by a matter of less than 1% of the vote. Just a few short weeks ago, there was a third candidate in the Democratic primary. That's State Senator Mallory McMorrow. She spoke to us after the primary about what happened. Mallory, welcome back to Stateside.
Hi, April. Thanks for having me.
So this race was so neck and neck. I have to ask, was there a moment when you were watching the returns last night when you thought, maybe I should have made that exit a little sooner?
Oh, gosh. You know, there's always a lot of woulda, coulda, shouldas. And what we knew, this has been out in public polling, but we knew internally that my supporters split almost 50-50 between Abdul and Haley. We wanted to make sure I made the best case to voters. So we had time to get our ads up on the air. And we did, you know, we shot our shot. We gave it everything I had. And then I had to take a really hard look at where we were. And I said then, you know, when I stepped back, it was about a month ago now, that I was going to let the voters decide. And whoever won the nomination would have my full support immediately after. So I thank everybody who supported me in my campaign and my commitment today, and hopefully you've seen it so far. I ran because I wanted to beat Mike Rogers, and that commitment remains as true today as it was when I was still in the race, and we're all locked in to do exactly that.
People I talked to who were excited about your candidacy told me that they felt you represented something of a middle ground between Haley, kitchen table issues approach, somewhat accessible to the business community, plus ironclad support for Israel, and Abdul's positions, centering Medicare for All, stances against corporations, and a voice for a lot of people who've been shattered by the carnage they see overseas at the hands of U.S. military or U.S. allies. Do you think that we stand today with anything truly resolved with this very close result? Both of their differing approaches seem to have supporters in Michigan.
I think that's exactly right. You know, we have seen so much coverage of this race, particularly from national reporters saying this is the race that is going to decide the direction of the Democratic Party, as if it was a binary, as if we had to go more traditional or if we had to go more progressive. And what I take away from not only the result, but the turnout, we had record turnout in this primary that dwarfed the turnout in the Republican primary. And the Republican primary had, you know, their own competitive races. But to me, people were looking for the wrong takeaway. It's not going left or going more center or going middle. It's recognizing in this moment, the Democratic Party is a big tent party and is growing. We saw that with the Democratic convention that we had for our party a few months back, where we had a record number of delegates turnout. And to me, that's really exciting. Now, anytime you're growing, there are growing pains. That is true. There are going to be disagreements. There are going to be issues that people don't necessarily agree on. But looking at those numbers, and you look at the ticket that we now have with Abdul, with Jocelyn Benson, with Garland Gilchrist, with Ellie Sabbat, it's the most diverse ticket we've ever had as Democrats, not only by race and by background and by gender, but by kind of flavor of Democrat. There is something in it for everybody. And I think if we take and adopt a team mentality, you don't have to agree with every Democrat on every issue, but you can find somebody who reflects you in this party and in this ticket, and we will have the numbers to soundly defeat Republicans in November. That is my takeaway, that it's a big tent party, and that is something to celebrate.
You endorsed Abdul El-Sayed, and I saw you at his victory speech standing beside him. Do you have any thoughts on whether Haley Stevens will do the same?
I know she will. You know, I saw her very gracious tweets and read her post this morning where, you know, whether it is any of us who are in this race, Michiganders are very clear-eyed about what the stakes actually are. And I have been not surprised to see how quickly, you know, we recognize we have to come together to be a team, and that is happening. So, you know, she is a great campaigner. You know, she and I both ran in 2018. We both flipped Republican districts. She has been somebody who always nerds out about policy. You know, she would call me sometimes at all hours to talk about policy, and we need that. So I was glad to see that. I'm not surprised. I know that it was a late night, particularly for her team. But there are going to be some unity breakfasts and events this week where we will all be there and we will all be united to win in November.
Some of Haley Stevens' supporters represent a slightly more conservative brand of Democratic voter. And some of her supporters are people whose main concern is just electability against Mike Rogers. The polls have been a little all over the place, but I wanted to ask you about one in particular. This is a Glenn Gariff poll from late July that showed Mike Rogers with a comfortable lead against Abdul El-Sayed in the general, 10 percentage points. What are your concerns?
I look at that and I think we just have to introduce more people to Abdul and make sure Michiganders know who Mike Rogers really is. He has TV ads where Mike Rogers is presenting himself as a pretty moderate, sane, rational Republican. He's got a Carhartt jacket on. He's talking about bringing shop class back into high school. All of that sounds fine. But then you listen to him give interviews. And he does nothing but fawn over Donald Trump. You know, he promised to be somebody who would help open the Gordie Howe Bridge. And then he was celebrating Donald Trump wanting to keep it closed and saying, good, the president needs leverage against Canada. He has been dismissive of Michiganders talking about how much the tariffs are hurting them and bringing their costs up. He dismissed the fact that the price of coffee was up and effectively said, who cares? And he stood on stage with President Trump just a few days ago in Oakland County and said that Michigan needs a senator who will not stand in the way of the president's agenda. That, to me, is unacceptable. Your job is not to represent the president. Your job is to represent Michiganders. So as we all move forward, it is going to be on all of us as Democrats and as this team to make sure people know who Mike Rogers really is, who he's going to work for. And the way that I see this race in November, especially given the Republican Party has been completely captured by Donald Trump, it is now the MAGA party. It is Michigan versus Donald Trump. And I'm going to take Michigan in that fight every day of the week.
There are some Haley Stevens supporters whose primary issue is the survival of Israel. And they, you know, there are some who have expressed themselves to reporters saying they feel like they just can't vote for Abdul, that he's too negative on Israel, not clear enough on its value as a U.S. ally. Do you think that there can be a meeting of the minds?
I really do believe that there can be. You know, historically, this is Carl Levin's seat, and Senator Levin built up a wonderful reputation, especially as somebody coming out of the Jewish community, but who always had an open door to the Arab American and Muslim community, and respected when there were disagreements, but always made everybody believe that the most important thing to him as a senator was our shared safety at home as Michiganders. We have a unique responsibility as a state, given that we have the largest Arab American population living side by side with a very significant Jewish population in the entire country. And we can, frankly, be the beacon of hope to show that, yeah, we live side by side and we can do that beautifully. I want to give a lot of credit to Abdul. He reached out to me shortly after I dropped out, and he is Muslim. I am in an interfaith marriage. My husband is Jewish. And we just had a long conversation about how beautiful it is that our kids live in a state where they could be friends with each other, our girls, even though they have different backgrounds and religions, and that we both share a belief that they deserve safety, that threats of Islamophobia are real, threats of anti-Semitism are real. And I think anchoring it there, you're gonna find a lot of agreement, because at the end of the day, everybody here in Michigan just wants to feel safe and secure and protected, no matter who they are, from any threats of hate. And that, I believe, is really uniting.
Mallory McMorrow represents the 8th District in Michigan State Senate in Lansing. Mallory, thank you for your time.
Thanks, April.
The state of Michigan must provide adequate health care to people locked inside its prisons. But inside the state's only prison for women, getting medical attention means fighting through a wall of institutional skepticism, even after 5 prisoners died this year. Michigan Public's Zina Issa reports.
In the days before 28-year-old Kyra Howard was scheduled to leave Huron Valley Women's Prison, she was wheelchair-bound.
It's hard because she told them, she said that she had no feeling in her legs. They kept calling her a liar.
Tina Stoll watches over her peers that the prison believes need to be monitored as part of her role as a prison observation aide. Stoll remembers Howard locked up in the infirmary yelling for help to get around.
This girl couldn't get out of her wheelchair. She slept in her wheelchair. She stayed in her wheelchair. And they just kept telling her she was faking, she was faking, she was faking.
Stoll says she was working a shift when she noticed Howard acting differently.
She was sounding like she was hallucinating. And I said, that's weird. What's happening in there? And then the very next day, she was deceased.
Howard passed away on May 13th, days before her scheduled release. The autopsy showed she wasn't faking it. The paralysis in her legs was caused by a blood clot lodged in her right lower leg that broke free, traveled to her lungs, and killed her. Her blood oxygen levels had also plummeted into the 70s, when normally that level should be close to 100. Those hallucinations Stoll overheard were Howard's brain being suffocated. Howard's autopsy showed it was a natural death. The State Corrections Department, which oversees Michigan's prisons, says it's investigating the events that led up to Howard's death, and when it's done, what it finds will be made public.
Four more women died. One was an elderly inmate whose death last week was expected.
It doesn't help that they believe everybody in here is drug-seeking. Everybody.
Stoll recalls crying in pain after a kidney surgery in October of 2023, only for staff to tell her she was being a wimp who just wanted pills.
Every day I was complaining. Man, my stomach really, really hurts. No, you're just looking to go to the hospital. You just want pain meds.
The corrections department says its medical staff are trained to identify signs of drug use and drug-seeking behaviors in their patients, and that staff are expected to use their expertise to assess all patients without bias. But women at Huron Valley Prison say the medical staff has missed what should be clear symptoms of other problems. 2 weeks after her surgery, Stoll was rushed to a hospital to find out she had a urine bubble under her kidney that had become infected. Another woman, Renietta Hamilton, suffered for years with irregular periods and heavy bleeding.
So I'm going to the OBGYN and really going through this process with them, but it's really not coming up with a solution.
Medical records show she first reported the symptoms in 2014. After 12 years of doctor's visits, birth control shots, and an IUD, this year, doctors at a hospital outside the facility found a lump of tissue in her uterus. Doctors believe this could be the cause of her excessive bleeding.
The staff, the healthcare staff is horrible. They'll like talk to you as if, you know, they talk to you the same way the correction officer talk to you, as if you're not here to help me.
Medical staff inside is kind of trained to assume that prisoners are lying and they're seeking drugs.
That's Jamie Hine. She's a PhD candidate at the University of Michigan who studies women's resistance in Michigan's prisons. Her insight comes from more than just academic research. She spent 10 years incarcerated herself while dealing with a lifelong illness.
If I didn't have my family to advocate for me on the outside, I don't know if I would have made it.
Hine believes the root of the crisis at Women's Huron Valley is that the state hires for-profit companies to provide medical services.
Their goal is not to deliver quality healthcare. It's to provide, you know, the least possible amount of care and make the most profit. That obviously is a huge, huge problem.
Michigan started privatizing prison healthcare almost 30 years ago. The state was able to save money because private companies restructured the medical workforce to rely heavily on lower credentialed, lower paid professionals. The Department of Corrections says all requests for care are triaged by nursing staff, and inmates have several options for making a report if they believe their healthcare needs are not being met.
MVOC employed more registered nurses, while the private companies employed more licensed practical nurses, LPNs, and resident care aides, which are prisoners actually doing care work for other prisoners.
Currently, the state contracts medical care out to Vital Core Health Strategies. The private company has faced lawsuits in various states for allegations of negligence and medical malpractice. But the department says it maintains regular oversight over the private contractor and that the state's chief medical officer holds the final authority over all clinical decisions. Vital Core took over a contract with the corrections department in 2024. That's after previous healthcare companies, Grand Prairie and WellPath, didn't pay their medical contractors, like doctors and local ambulance teams, and then they filed for bankruptcy.
They may be under a different private equity umbrella, but they are ultimately the same group of people running the show.
In September, the state's multi-million-dollar contract with Vital Core will expire, but it has the option to renew it. After the fourth woman died at the prison in early July, I checked back in with Tina Stoll and Renietta Hamilton. Both say conditions haven't improved. Stoll says she found out she's in stage 4 kidney failure.
When I talked to my doctor, he said he was going to do tests to see why my kidney was shutting down, but I haven't seen anybody since.
And when was that?
That was almost 2 months ago.
Hamilton was able to regulate her period after she underwent surgery, but she doesn't believe the healthcare will get any better.
I have gotten some services that have been done in some of my issues, but would I say that for the population? Absolutely not.
And while the state trims balance sheets and healthcare groups cut corners, the women inside Women's Huron Valley wonder what it will take to finally get their healthcare concerns taken seriously. For Michigan Public, I'm Zina Issa.
That's all for Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.